books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today's show is part one of our review of 2023. Coming up, we'll hear from C.K. MacDonald about The Stranger Times. We'll chat to narrator Gabriel Wolfe, who first read for RNIB 60 years ago. We'll hear from Catherine Simpson about her book One Body, a retrospective. First up, though, back in January, we spoke to Randy Dawn about Tune In Tomorrow, a funny, thrilling and mysterious adventure into the world of alternate reality TV. Randy Dawn writes about entertainment glam by day and fantastical fiction worlds by night. Her debut novel, Tune In Tomorrow, the curious, calamitous, cockamamie story of Star Weatherby and the greatest mythic reality show ever, is now available in the UK in both print and as an audiobook. Randy's a former Soap Opera Digest editor and now writes about showbiz for Variety, The Los Angeles Times, Today.com and other publications. So when she joined me down the line from her home in Brooklyn, New York, we not only talked about the book, but we talked about soap operas in America and the UK, about feature writing and about the British sense of humour. First though, let's hear from the audio version of Tune In Tomorrow, read by Rebecca Lachance.
Fork, knife, spoon, napkin, ring, stack. Knife, fork, spoon, napkin, ring, stack. Variations on a theme, thought Star Weatherby, her blue nail-polished fingers on autopilot as she crafted stainless steel utensil rolls, yearning to be anywhere but here. She was 47 minutes into her shift at Mike's Diner. It was 6:32 a.m. on a summer Thursday, and she had 73 more rolls to construct before Mike would even consider letting her have the privilege of waiting on tables again. All around her, Mike's thrummed. Grease pans sizzling, plates clattering, short-order cooks swearing in multiple tongues. Regulars flirted with waitresses, whose shoes made smuck-smuck sounds on the linoleum as they negotiated the packed booths and tables. A fug of burned pancakes, buttery eggs, fatty bacon, and defrosted juices lingered in the air, settling on Star's thick blonde curls. All the while, Mike and his manicured handlebar mustache lurked behind the register. He rattled the pages of the New York Post while casting a gimlet eye around the room. Star stood to one side of the coffee and supply station, spinning her utensil packages, bored, solid. The subway had stalled underground this morning, making her late. 11 minutes into her shift, she'd sworn under her breath, and a customer had overheard her. But really, was craptacular a swear? Then delivered regular instead of Canadian bacon to table 12. She was distracted for a good reason, but in Mike's, three strikes and you're doomed to make 100 utensil rolls, plus miss getting tips until you finished. Dang Canadians, she grumbled to herself. Who wants your dumb hammy bacon anyway?
Tune In Tomorrow is about a reality TV show run by mythical creatures for mythical creatures, but starring humans. I'm an entertainment journalist and I used to work at a soap opera magazine, so I've sort of seen the sausage been made. I've gone behind the scenes. I've met a bunch of actors. I will not confirm or deny if any of the characters in the book are inspired by some of these actors that I may have met, but I will say, you know, you can draw your own conclusions.
We love shows about dragons and magic and things like that, but I assume the mythical creatures themselves wouldn't find that interesting.
And that's kind of one of the conceits of the book. When I was coming up with the whole idea of the book, I was thinking, well, if we, you know, I don't think mythical creatures are going to sit around and listen to lutes all day or read poems. You know, they can move with the modern times. What kind of TV shows are they going to watch? What kind of movies are they going to watch? And you know, the way that we like to watch shows like Game of Thrones, which have dragons and some magic and castles and all that kind of stuff, that would be very mundane for them. So we tend to enjoy watching stories that are about things we don't know, explore things that are unusual to us. And so the things that are mundane to us, I think, would be interesting to mythical creatures. And when I started digging into that, I thought, well, the kind of programming that really shows that is reality shows and soap operas. I mean, yes, both can go over and over the top and beyond all the time. But I do believe that the idea of an ordinary human life, you know, what is embezzlement? What is adultery? How do you write a check? Why do you like hot water versus cold water? You know, all these kind of things. And I tried to then extrapolate that into the kind of show that they would then watch.
He leaned over her shoulder and she caught a musky scent reminiscent of sweet hay and almost, but not quite, forgot her name again. Quite a performance, darling, that sing-song voice crooned, and a business card slipped into her hand. Valentine raised his head and addressed the room. Do phone sometime, Star Weatherby. I know all kinds of great lawyers who will help you advance your case. With that, Valentine headed to the door where his friends waited. He half turned and winked. Star's heart paused. A long, narrow tail tipped in fur darted out from his overcoat. The weirdo trio from Table 5 disappeared through the doorway. Tail? Star thought, head whirling. Horns? Seriously? She'd heard of the devil in the details, but never in the diner. The corners of the business card bit into her hand, and she turned her palm up. Jason Valentine, it read, with a local phone number beneath in curiously pulsing, scripted numerals. Executive producer. Tune in tomorrow.
Yeah, it's called the greatest mythic reality show ever, but I read that in an earlier draft it was originally a soap opera.
Correct, yeah. So my interest was in making it a soap opera. And I think the thing is that you kind of can see that it is a hybrid of soap opera and reality TV. Netflix came up with the idea of docu-soap. I think they came up with that idea. They use it in any case. And I completely stole that because what happened is it was basically a straight up soap opera. And my editors at my publisher, Solaris, said, you know, look, people don't watch soap operas anymore, and you should maybe consider doing this as a reality show. And I'm like, please buy my book. I will do what you tell me to do. So that was a relatively easy cosmetic change to make because reality TV shows, and I'm not talking about necessarily the competition ones, but the ones that are more like about everyday life, even if everyday life is very wealthy, like life. I mean, it's like the Real Housewives shows or the Kardashians and that kind of stuff. That's basically soap opera. And if anybody who thinks that it isn't at least partially scripted is fooling themselves. It may not be quite as scripted as the show in Tune In Tomorrow, but it's definitely, there's some scripting going on because as I was noting earlier, like if you said, Randy, we're going to film your life as a reality show, that would be very boring, especially since I'm a writer and that's not interactive. Eventually you would say, well, Randy, why don't you go to the store today and you'll stumble into your ex-boyfriend. That would be interesting, wouldn't it? So I think reality shows are in some way pretty heavily scripted or at least heavily produced. So I just took the idea and melded the two of them. I said, let's make this, the reason it's a reality show is that the mythical creatures believe it's real. And meanwhile, we can still tell stories that are pretty heavily soap operatic.
For the full interview with Randy Doan and an interview with narrator Rebecca Lachance, head to episode 303. That was in January. In February, we stayed in the world of Supernatural with The Stranger Times and C.K. MacDonald. C.K. MacDonald is the author of The Stranger Times series of books. Book 1, The Stranger Times, and Book 2, This Charming Man, are both available in audio from RNIB Talking Books. Book 1's also available in Braille. And just out is book three in the series Love Will Tear Us Apart, which we'll talk about in a moment. Also, under the name Cueve MacDonald, he's the author of the increasingly inaccurately titled Dublin Trilogy, which has 8 books at the moment with more on the way. All of these books are available in audio, so let's listen to a clip of the newest one. Love Will Tear Us Apart, Stranger Times Book 3, is narrated by Brendan MacDonald.
Tristan Bleeker's mind went blank. Staring down the wrong end of a gun will have that effect on a man. His mouth was dry. His palms were sweaty. He found himself utterly incapable of summoning a single coherent thought. Not that he had much experience of these things, but it was not a normal gun. Instead of the typical straight barrel, the muzzle of this one flared out like the bell of a trombone. He kept his eyes fixed down the centre line of it, as if he might discern the spark in the darkness that would herald the eventful end to his previously uneventful life. It was like looking into the nostril of an irritable dragon, one that could barbecue you with a single breath.
"Do I need to repeat the question?"
asked the voice at the other end of the weapon. It sounded oddly weary, as if Tristram were the 10th or so person it had held at gunpoint that day, and the process was becoming entirely tedious. Tristram's lips moved, but no words emerged. The voice tutted.
"This is not going well."
That's Brendan MacDonald reading from the new Stranger Times book, Love Will Tear Us Apart, which is out now. And the author C.K. MacDonald, our Cueve MacDonald, joins me now. Now, I believe I got your name right by saying Cueve.
Bang on. Very impressively. Genuinely, I've done quite a lot of interviews and... you, sir, are one of the very few people who managed to get it without asking. To the point where when I meet people now, I generally sort of reintroduce myself when I met them before because I know people get so scared by the name. Because for anyone listening, it's spelled C-A-I-M-H. And it genuinely helps to have not seen it written down before you try and say it, because the phonetic spelling of it features none of the letters that are in my name. It's ridiculous.
I had a wee head start because I knew a girl called Niamh, N-A-I-M-H, but you're the first Cueve I've come across.
Yeah, no, it's quite, I mean, weirdly, to be honest, it's not, frankly, a proper name, depending on who you ask, because basically what Cueve is it's a nicknameified shortened version of Cueveen, which is the original Gaelic of Kevin. So when I was playing in bands and stuff in Dublin, people just started calling me Cueve, and it sort of hung on and I always liked it. And then as people always go, well, was it a stage name? You go, no, it's what my wife calls me. It's my name in Irish. It is my name, but it's a version of my name I prefer using. But then obviously the Stranger Times books are a C.K. MacDonald because... publishers were terrified of the name. So they were like, can we use a different one for, because, you know, bless them, they're lovely people at Transworld. But you said the meeting genuinely with the editor when it was coming up, because we basically, myself and my agent, already agreed but it made sense to have my two different sets of books under two different names. But my agent, who's a lovely man, but is tremendously English, and I mean that in the nicest way possible, but tremendously English, and you can literally see him twisting in his chair, dreading having to ask the question to an Irishman, would you mind changing your name?
Now, as we say, well, we're here to talk about the Stranger Times, but you have another set of books called the Dublin Trilogy, which, yeah, they were self-published, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, genuinely, this is absolutely true. It was like 2015, 2016, because I wrote a book that's, it sort of mixes comedy and crime, set in Dublin, The Man at One of Those Faces. And when we went looking for a representation, which is kind of what you have to do before you publish and stuff, nobody was interested. We were told comedy and crime didn't mix. We were actually told, genuine feedback we got was that it was too funny and too Irish. Which is wonderfully, I'm so tempted to send that guy an email every few weeks. I never do, because it's an excessive move, but the temptation to go, by the way, they've now sold for knocking on near, well, not quite a million, but they're heading that direction. So yeah, no, they came out and then people just sort of latched onto them, and they sort of built. We were sort of really pleasantly surprised. I'd never written a book before. It turned out I really enjoyed writing them. And then the audiobooks particularly really helped because we got a guy called Morgan C. Jones, who's an incredible narrator. We are blessed with the narrators we have. They're actually, by coincidence, both happen to be Irish. Well, Morgan deliberately was Irish, but Brendan ended up sort of accidentally the guy who does Strange Times. It's what's really funny about the two voices are they're also two of the premier voiceover artists in Ireland. So every time I ring my mother and she doesn't pick up the phone, Brendan informs me that her mailbox is full. And then when I try and ring my sister at some point, I think it was Morgan who was informing me that she wasn't there. As well as every time I'm sitting in the cinema or something in Ireland or listening to an advert on TV, the amount of stuff they try and sell me in the space of a couple of hours is incredible. But yeah, so and then the audiobooks, people really latched on to Morgan, particularly with the Dublin books, and that really sort of they're very popular. To be honest, I'm a big fan of audiobooks in general from my stand-up days when I listened to them a lot when you were driving around. If you actually want to get good opinions on audiobooks, stand-up comedians, so many of them are massive fans of audiobooks because we do so much driving that I'd imagine, honestly, probably the Oran and IB and then stand-up comedians are probably the two groups in Britain that are most likely to be big audiobook fans. Just a bizarre, it's a bizarre thing. But yeah, because so many comics, like all my friends, any comics who've read my books, they've all done it through the audiobooks because, you know, because they do so much driving. And I would say the audiobook is honestly probably the best way to, in some ways, I think, enjoy the books. I think the actors involved have done such a good job that I think they really add to it.
Bridget stopped to look in a shop window, checking she hadn't picked up a tail. She'd seen this on telly numerous times. You look in the reflection to see if anyone is following you. It was proving trickier than she'd imagined. In a movie, the extras would all walk by in straight lines and some over-muscled Eastern European guy would stutter-step, look around in confusion, and give himself away. In reality, actual people were proving to be much messier than that. She'd never noticed before, but on a cold winter's day, pretty much everyone was wearing a long black overcoat. It looked like a hitman convention back there.
It's quite unusual that a self-published book has an audio version. How did that come about?
Well, it's just, yeah, people were asking. And to be honest, the reason most self-published books don't have audio versions is it's expensive. And in all honesty, and Morgan won't mind me saying this, Morgan, as I said, is one of the top voiceover guys in Ireland. So he's not cheap because he shouldn't be, frankly. I would always say that in an interview ago, he's going to ask for another rise. But he's brilliant. But basically, the books took off and then it sort of made sense. We actually were looking at me doing them myself, to the point where I got myself a little sound recording booth and I started doing lessons because I was a stand-up comedian, but I've never known how to talk properly. Even now, your listeners will be aware of the fact that I speak far too quickly and quite indistinctly at times. So, but we were still going to try and do it with me. And I started, and then the book started taking off and then we just sort of looked at it and went, oh, maybe we should try and get someone else. And we did some auditions and Morgan was just so good that it's just one of these things where you'd be amazed only when you hear lots of people do it badly, a 5-minute sample. Like, and these are all actors, with all due respect to them, but just not hitting lines properly. It's amazing. When you hear that, I was already a fan of how good narrators can be, but you hear a really good person do it and you went, wow, this is so different. Because and Morgan has, if you listen to the books, the great thing about him is actually his delivery is probably slower than most people's would be. Because he has the confidence in what he's doing. And I mean, he says himself, he's the confidence in the material. So he lets it breathe and it ends up being a much better experience because I think a lot of narrators can try and rush through stuff. Whereas he's just got the experience to do that and he's a wonderful flow to it. So yeah, it just ended up when the book started taking off and we frankly struck gold when we got a narrator that just fit it perfectly.
Yeah, I've heard sometimes writers say it's a bit of a surreal experience. It almost sounds like they're listening to something they didn't write.
Yeah, it can be. Weirdly, I remember I was at the Harrogate Crime Writing Festival, which I go to pretty much every year. Myself and the wife love it. But I remember it coming up on one of the panels a few years ago, audiobooks. And everybody in the panel went, oh, yeah, I've not heard my audiobooks. No, I mean, I've just heard a sample and it sounded like the guy was a good voice or the woman was a good voice. But I've not sat down and listened to it. And I'm like, wow, really? It's like, I can't not paying attention to the cover. Like, it's a big deal. A good narrator can make a series. And alternatively, a narrator people don't like can kill a series. So, you know, it's really important. Once you've had someone, you know, like I know Brendan, who does the Strange Times. I know he does a great job. I know Morgan, who does the the Bunny books. I know he does a fantastic job. So at this point, I don't check everything. But yeah, certainly for the first book, we were all over it to make sure that it was done as well as it could be. And we were talking to the narrators and stuff like that. Because it's a massively important thing, especially because I write a very diverse bunch of people. And in the Stranger Times, my wife is second generation Ghanaian. And I've used the thing a couple of times where I've based characters on my mother-in-law, which I probably should stop doing for many reasons, not least because it's a challenge to get people to correctly get a female Ghanaian accent correct. Brendan was so great because we were like giving him loads of tips to make sure that he was, you know, getting the accent as he wanted it and stuff. And being a very good actor, he was able to take it all on board. But yeah, we've been very involved in it because I think it's just a massively important part of your book, you know, how the audiobook is.
Thanks again to Cueve MacDonald. The third book in the Stranger Times trilogy entered the RNIB Talking Books Library shortly after that interview. And talking of the RNIB Library and new books, here's Lynn Livingston.
We have a sunny treat for the depths of winter. Late Summer on the Vineyard by Joe Thomas was donated to us by Headline.
Madame! Madame! I shout and wave my arms around like I'm at a Take That concert, trying to attract Gary Barlow's attention in the midst of thousands of other Possessed fans. The midday sun beats down on the back of my head, making me dizzy and reminding me I'm in southwest France. A small town called Petit Frère, to be precise, on the banks of the Dordogne. It's a long way from Bristol Airport, where I started out first thing this morning, with my boss's words still ringing in my ears. I'm giving you one last chance, Emmy. I mean it. Don't blow it. And I don't intend to, believe me. Madame! I call again, perspiring in my non-creased navy suit, waving and then pointing to the old worn leather purse left on the bench beside the fountain in the middle of the square. But the old lady just glances round at me, glares and hurries on. The fountain is spouting water into the pool at its feet, but even its gentle splashing doesn't make me feel any cooler. Just beyond the fountain there is a sandy bull's pitch right by the river bank where a leaning weeping willow brushes its boughs across the surface of the fast-moving water. There are benches either side of the pitch, and three old men in short-sleeved shirts are sitting on one under the shade of a plane tree.
Emmy Bridges has always looked out for others. It's time she put down roots of her own. Working for a winemaker in France is the opportunity of a lifetime for Emmy, even if she doesn't know a thing about wine beyond what's on offer at the local supermarket. There's plenty to get to grips with in the rustic town of Petit Frère. Emmy's new work friends need more than a little winning over. And then there's her infuriatingly brash tutor, Isaac, and the enigmatic Madame Beaumont, tucked away in her vineyard of secrets. But Emmy will soon realise that in life, just as in winemaking, the best things happen when you let go and trust your instincts, particularly when there's romance in the air.
Around the outside of the square are shops, including a boulangerie, a baker's, and an épicerie with fruit and vegetables laid out under a green and white sun-bleached awning. People are buying their lunchtime loaves, and the warm smell of bread is wrapping itself around me. There's a busy cafe, too, with round silver-topped tables outside, and men in overalls smoking and drinking small cups of coffee and glasses of cream-coloured cloudy liquid. I look around hopefully for someone to come to my aid and help give the purse back to the old lady. But everyone just seems to be staring at the four of us like we've arrived from another planet. And quite frankly, that's how it feels. The woman had stopped at an empty bench by the fountain to rearrange her shopping between her two baskets, distributing the weight more evenly, no doubt. She'd put down her purse while doing so and then left it behind on the bench. I looked towards the épicerie for help, hoping someone's seen what's happened. An assistant is busy serving a young mum with a toddler in a pushchair. She hands the child a big round peach, and they all coo in delight when the child takes it and bites into it with relish. I can smell the ripe strawberries on the table outside from here. Why don't strawberries smell like that back home? In fact, everything about here smells different. The hot coffee, baking bread, even the tobacco smoke from the cafe and the hot sun on tarmac roads. Every breath tells me I'm in France, even if I still don't quite believe it yet myself.
Late Summer in the Vineyard by Joe Thomas is narrated by Rachel Atkins and runs for 12 hours 19 minutes.
We have the first book in a new crime series by Sharon Bolton, The Craftsman, which was donated by Orion.
On the hottest day of the year, Larry Glassbrook has come home to his native Lancashire for the last time, and the townsfolk have turned out to say goodbye, not in a friendly way. It might be just fancy on my part, but the crowd outside the church seems to have grown during the brief, chill funeral service, swelling the numbers that arrived early to claim a good spot, the way people do before a big parade. Everywhere I look, people stand among headstones, flank the perimeter wall, and line the footpaths like some ghastly guard of honour. As we follow the coffin out into sunshine bright enough to cauterize wounds, they watch us, without moving or speaking. The press are here in force, in spite of the date being kept secret for as long as possible. Uniformed police hold them back, keeping the paths and the porch clear. But the photographers have brought stepladders and huge telescopic lenses. The rounded, fluffy microphones of the news presenters look powerful enough to pick up the scampering of church mice. I keep my eyes down, push my sunglasses a little higher on my nose, although I know I look very different now. 30 years is a long time.
Devoted father or merciless killer, his secrets are buried with him. Florence Lovelady's career was made when she convicted coffin maker Larry Glassbrook of a series of child murders 30 years ago. Like something from our worst nightmares, the victims were buried, alive. Larry confessed to the crimes, it was an open and shut case, but now he's dead and events from the past start to repeat themselves. Did she get it all wrong all those years ago? Or is there something much darker at play? Also available is the second book in the series, The Buried.
A few yards ahead of me, beads of moisture swell and burst on the necks of the pallbearers. These men leave a trail behind them, a smell of aftershave and beer-infused sweat, of suits that aren't dry-cleaned quite often enough. Standards have slipped since Larry's day. The men who worked for Glassbrook and Greenwood funeral directors wore suits as black as newly mined coal. Their shoes and hair gleamed, and they shaved so close as to leave raw, rash-scarred skin behind. Larry's men carried the caskets reverently, like the works of art they were. Larry would never have permitted the cheap laminate coffin I can see in front of me. Knowing that his own funeral fell short of the standards he'd insisted upon could have been a bitter disappointment to Larry. On the other hand, he might have laughed, loudly and cruelly, the way he did sometimes, when you least expected it, when it was most unnerving. And then he might have run his fingers through his black hair, winked suggestively, and resumed dancing to the Elvis Presley tracks that seemed constantly to be playing in his workshop. After all this time, even thinking about Elvis Presley's music sets my heart racing.
The Craftsman by Sharon Bolton is narrated by Nathalie Buscombe and runs for 11 hours 56 minutes.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And today's show is a look back at some interviews from last year, one of which was with one of the most distinctive and prolific voices in the RNIB Talking Books Library, who first recorded for RNIB around 60 years ago, Mr. Gabriel Wolfe.
His first credit as an actor was in Tom Brown's School Days in 1951, followed a few years later with a role in the 1953 MGM film Knights of the Round Table, then many other roles on TV. His real love, though, is narration and radio.
presenting a large number of literary and musical portraits, and of course reading for the Talking Book Service. A search in the library for his name delivers over 140 books, although that doesn't reflect instances where a book has been replaced by a more up-to-date version, so I suspect the number is much, much higher. And an email that went first to Hamburg via his wife, soprano Felicity Lott's website, to Barcelona, and eventually to Gabriel's home in Sussex. We started a correspondence, got Zoom installed on his computer, and he joined me down the line. I first asked when he started reading for RNIB.
Sometime in the 60s, but exactly when, I don't know. I should imagine about 63, 64. I worked a lot for radio, and so when you were talking to other artists and you talked about work, and I suppose somebody must have said, why don't you go along? It's only up the road. It was Great Portland Street. It was and have a word and see if they want you, you know, to do some, to do these books. And I went and I got taken on. And it was generally regarded as a charitable act, but it was paid minuscule amounts by the minute of recording. So you did a morning's work and it went on for a couple of hours altogether, probably. It was just a few pounds, £5, £6, £7, £7, something like that. But it was all a help because we were all jobbing actors just trying desperately to make a living, and newsreaders. But it suited me very well because I have always been interested in reading aloud. And I used to read aloud to myself when I was a child. And it went on, and I read to anybody who would listen, and it still goes on. I still do it.
It all began with William's aunt, who was in a good temper that Saturday morning and gave him a shilling for posting a letter for her and carrying her parcels from the grocer's. Buy some sweets or go to the pictures, she said carelessly as she gave it to him. William walked slowly down the road, gazing thoughtfully at the coin. After deep calculations based on the fact that a shilling is the equivalent of 2 sixpences, he came to the conclusion that both luxuries could be indulged in. He could get into the stalls for sixpence, and that left 6 months, more than enough at the current cost of living, to keep him munching happily while he gazed at the screen. In the matter of sweets, William frankly upheld the superiority of quantity over quality. Moreover, he knew every sweet shop within a 2-mile radius of his home, whose proprietor added an extra sweet after the scale had descended, and he patronised these shops exclusively. With solemn face and eager eye, he always watched the process of weighing, and stingy shops were known and banned by him. He wandered now to his favourite confectioner, and stood outside the window for 5 minutes, torn between the rival attractions of gooseberry eyes and marble balls. Both were sold at 4 ounces for tuppence. William never purchased more expensive luxuries. At last, his frowning brow relaxed, and he entered the shop. 6 pennyworth of gooseberry eyes, he said, with a slightly self-conscious air. The extent of his purchases rarely exceeded a penny. Hello, said the shopkeeper in amused surprise. Got a bit of money this morning, explained William carelessly, with the air of a Rothschild. He watched the weighing of the emerald-green dainties with silent intensity, saw with satisfaction the extra one added after the scale had fallen, received the precious paper bag, and putting 2 sweets into his mouth, walked out of the shop.
And what sort of books do you remember reading? Have you got any favourites that have stuck in your mind?
Not really, because, you know, it came and it went, and it was a job, and I can remember sort of selecting from the available books, and obviously every George Eliot book that was available I read, because she was the other part of my life for 50-odd years. So Middlemarch was a tremendous thing to do. I loved that. I seem to have enjoyed doing things like raffles, the amateur cracksman. I like that sort of light stuff, but I don't really remember what I read and what I didn't read. Treasure Island, I read that. I heard that not long ago, and it really wasn't bad. Whereas I can't. I mean, the classic was that they wanted Thucydides, Peloponnesian War recorded, and everybody rejected it, but I didn't. I love the idea, and I it was an education for me. I hadn't had much education, and so it was a good opportunity. I like that. I like those books about archaeology and history and things like that, whereas the other people really liked something, a nice, easy read.
I do not understand these long speeches which the Athenians make. Although they said a great deal in praise of themselves, they made no attempt to contradict the fact that they are acting aggressively against our allies and against the Peloponnese. And surely if it is the fact that they had a good record in the past against the Persians, and now have a bad record as regards us, then they deserve to pay double for it, since though they were once good, they have now turned out bad. We are the same then and now. And if we're sensible, we shall not allow any aggression against our allies, and shall not wait before we come to their help. They are no longer waiting before being ill-treated. Others may have a lot of money and ships and horses, but we have good allies, and we ought not to betray them to the Athenians. This is not a matter to be settled by lawsuits and by words. It is not because of words that our own interests are suffering. Instead, we should come to the help of our allies quickly and with all our might. And let no one try to tell us that when we are being attacked, we should sit down and discuss matters. These long discussions are rather for those who are meditating aggression themselves. Therefore, Spartans, cast your votes for the honor of Sparta and for war. Do not allow the Athenians to grow still stronger. Do not entirely betray your allies. Instead, let us, with the help of heaven, go forward to meet the aggressor.
So you appreciated a bit of a challenge, but were there any yes. books you were glad to see the back of?
Not as a challenge. Well, yes. I mean, not because it was too difficult, but because it was so badly written. I can't remember what it was. Doctors and Nurses. They begged me to read some popular books as well. And it was a kind of Mills and Boone effort. The writing was so excruciating. It's the only one I took back and said, look, I can't do this because I should just break up every cent. Oh, it was awful. But I just got on with it. I mean, the key to it all was my ability to read at sight. I could make it live without having to work at it. I could just read ahead, and I was very fluent and very coloured. I coloured things a good deal. And I must say that the audience were apparently divided into two, those who liked it living like that and with, you know, characters and dialects and a lot of involvement, and those who preferred the newsreaders because they wanted just to hear the words and put the imagination to work and do it themselves. So it's quite interesting.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights.
by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy A Book for the Younger Listener or Young at Heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
Still to come on today's show, we'll have two new gems in the RNIB Talking Books Library with Lynn Livingston. But our final interview from the first half of 2023 is with Catherine Simpson. She was on the show to talk about her book, One Body, a retrospective.
In our dressing up box, my sisters and I had a pair of Victorian wireframe spectacles. We took turns sitting on the wall at the front of the farmhouse, the world swimming through the lenses, waiting for the occasional car to pass by in the hope that the driver would think we were intelligent and interesting enough to need glasses. In fact, I was short-sighted and did need glasses, but nobody noticed until I was 8 and had a school eye test, by which time I could no longer read the blackboard.
One Body, a Retrospective, is my memoir, which is about growing up and growing older in a woman's body. And I wrote it when I got breast cancer, which was now 4 years ago. I wanted to find a book that would help me through the experience, and I couldn't find the right kind of book. So I decided to write it. But in writing about having breast cancer, it made me realise that my body sort of told the story of my life. And so the book became something much more than about breast cancer. It became about being born into a woman's body, going through my teens, all that puberty, all that brings with it, having children, unwanted pregnancies, early menopause and breast cancer. So it kind of covered the whole gamut in the end, although it was originally written when I was going through breast cancer.
You couldn't find a book that was written during rather than after breast cancer?
That's right. There are many, many books about cancer, of course, but most of them are written afterwards. And obviously, after an event, you have a different perspective on it, and you can then be far more positive, cheerful, maybe blasé or humorous. But I wanted to have somebody hold my hand who really was going through what I was going through, which a lot of it was terrifying, the experience. So I wanted to have a more raw account of what it's like to have breast cancer, which is, I think, One Body, what One Body is. But having said that, the book itself is humorous in that it recounts lots of experiences that do have an absurd side to them, because life, even though it can be terribly hard and terrifying, there is always this absurd, funny side to it. So it's definitely got humour in it, but it is raw about the experience of cancer.
Now, you mentioned puberty and adolescence there, and the subtitle of your previous memoir, When I Had a Little Sister, was The Story of a Family Who Never Spoke. Now, I know that refers to your sister's mental illness, but was that true growing up as well? Were you left to discover things about your body on your own?
Oh, absolutely. I was writing about this again yesterday. It's a recurring theme, really, in what I'm writing, that we weren't given the tools somehow to talk. And it wasn't just our family. I mean, I think it was a generational thing and a farming thing. But we never talked about anything personal, not bodily, not emotionally, nothing. The conversation was around the farm, the animals, the weather, that sort of thing. We never talked about how we felt personally about things, and certainly about learning about your body and going through, you know, puberty and so on. No, I mean, it happened and took me by surprise, really. I kept expecting it to go backwards. I was disappointed in that. So, it's a recurring theme in all my writing, is this the way that silence reigned a lot of the time. And when silence reigns and you don't have the words or the opportunity to talk about things, you end up feeling shamed by them. And then that shame can linger. And it's really only by writing about it, you know, writing about all these experiences, that I faced it down, that shame, and I don't feel ashamed about things anymore, you know, that have kind of hung around me for years. There were things in One Body that I'm writing about that I've never told anyone before. And, you know, but it was very, I don't really like the word cathartic, but it was kind of cathartic to write about it. and to say, this is nothing to be ashamed of. I'm just going to be open and honest about this.
NHS spectacles came in pink, blue or tortoiseshell. I refused the pink because they were too albino rabbit. And the tortoiseshell ones were for clever boys with short back and sides who did their own experiments. So I ended up with the pale blue.
Now, you narrated the audio version of One Body and the previous book, When I Had a Little Sister. How was the recording process?
It was absolutely an amazing experience. It was very, very intense. When I was recording When I Had a Little Sister, I did it in a studio in Edinburgh. And it's just me in the room in this, with this orange, you know, pool of light on my script and the sound engineers behind a window. It felt really like it was just me, and there was nobody else in the world, it felt like. Yeah, it was a really, really intense experience. But whilst I was reading the Have I Got a Little Sister, that was when I just found out I got cancer. So I think that made it feel even more intense. So then when I was back in the studio, it's actually a different studio, recording One Body, and I write in One Body about the experience of recording the first book. So reading One Body out saying, and I'm sitting in a studio reading my book, and the sound engineer is looking at me, shrugging through the window, going, what? This is like, you know, your life's in some kind of loop, like a hall of mirrors, you know? So, yeah, they were both really, really intense experiences, but I really wanted to do it myself. I said to my editor the first time, you know, you need somebody with a Lancashire accent to read this book, and it's really got to be me. And she said, great, you do it then. So I was really grateful for that, because I have been given some training in reading out loud, sort of performance reading, by the Scottish Book Trust. So I was fairly confident that I could do it, but it was great that it actually did work, and it worked really well. My voice reading my words seems to me appropriate.
Thanks once again to Catherine Simpson. That whole interview can be heard in episode 309. Gabriel Wolfe in episode 312. C.K. MacDonald in episode 308, and Randy Dawn and Rebecca LaChance on Tune In Tomorrow was episode 303. You can find the show on your favourite podcast app or at rnib.org.uk, or simply search for RNIB Read On. And finally, on today's show, a return to Lynn Livingston to find two brand new book suggestions available in audio from RNIB Talking Books.
Katie Flynn is one of our readers' favourite authors. Penguin Random House has shared her latest, Winter's Orphan.
Libby took a large bite of her apple as she made her way from her parents' furniture and bric-a-brac stall in Petticoat Lane to the house they rented on Whitechapel Road. Britain had been at war with the Germans for the best part of a year, though they'd seen little sign of action as yet. And with people christening it the Phony War, Libby and her parents were beginning to think that Hitler wasn't going to bother attacking north of the English Channel.
They bit off more than they could chew in the first lot, her father Reggie had assured her. They won't make the same mistake twice.
Libby's mother Orla was quick to agree with her husband.
He tries bombing us, and it'll be the biggest mistake of his life. Us Brits won't roll over like the rest of them.
Libby had eyed her parents dubiously.
What about Dunkirk?
We rescued our boys,
Orla had begun proudly, before being interrupted by her daughter.
They shouldn't have needed rescuing.
Then, hesitant, in case she might upset her parents, Libby continued candidly.
We might not have rolled over, but we did run away.
Reggie scowled at his daughter from over the top of his newspaper.
We didn't run away.
Disappearing behind the pages again, he continued stiffly.
It was a tactical manoeuvre so that we could regroup.
London, 1939. When tragedy strikes, Libby Andrews is left homeless and destitute, fending for herself on the capital's most dangerous streets. Desperate times call for desperate measures, and Libby is on the cusp of making a decision that could jeopardise her future when a local boy saves her from ruin. The kindness of this stranger sets her on a different path.
and Libby heads to Liverpool with a determined mind and hope in her heart. There she reconnects with lost family, but will she be able to uncover the truth that tore them apart all those years ago?
That conversation had taken place several weeks earlier, and as there was still no sign of Hitler's invading Britain, Libby had begun to think that her parents had been right. Now, as she turned off Middlesex Street onto Goulston Street, she nearly collided with Mrs. Fortescue, who lived on the same street. The old woman grinned toothily.
"Hello, Libby, love. You on your way home?"
"I certainly am, Mrs. F," said Libby pleasantly.
"I hope Pete's not packed up for the evening," said Mrs. Fortescue. "I forgot to get carrots when I went shopping earlier."
"He's still there," Libby assured her.
"You know Pete. He won't call it a day until the streets are deserted."
It was the last week of her summer holidays, and Libby was going to miss the camaraderie of the other traders. She simply adored market life. So much so, she'd even suggested to her father that she might pack school in so that she could help him out permanently. But Reggie had been adamant that he wanted better for his daughter. "Me and your mum work hard to make sure you have a good future and that you don't have to stand behind a market stall in all weathers," had been his reply. "You may think it's fun in the summertime when the sun's shining, but I've noticed you're not so keen come Christmas when the snow's thick on the ground."
"But trading's in me blood," Libby had insisted.
"Only 'cause you know no different," retorted Reggie. "If you get yourself a decent education, you'll be able to work yourself out of this hellhole. Maybe even meet a decent man whilst you're about it." Libby wrinkled the side of her nose in a reproving fashion.
"If a pen pusher is your idea of a decent man, they're nowt but stuck-up snobs who wouldn't look twice at a girl like me."
"They would if you had yourself a good job, though," Reggie pointed out.
"This is a good job," argued Libby. "Everything we own has been paid for by the sweat of our brow. If that ain't decent, I don't know what is."
Winter's Orphan by Katie Flynn is read by Anne Dover and runs for 11 hours, 10 minutes.
For those who prefer some heavier reading, we have A Brief History of Intelligence by Max Bennett, which was donated by HarperCollins.
Life existed on Earth for a long time, and I mean a long time, over 3 billion years, before the first brain made an appearance. By the time the first brains evolved, life had already persevered through countless evolutionary cycles of challenge and change. In the grand arc of life on Earth, the story of brains would not be found in the main chapters, but in the epilogue. Brains appeared only in the most recent 15% of life's story. Intelligence, too, existed for a long time before brains. As we will see, life began exhibiting intelligent behavior early in its story. We cannot understand why and how brains evolved without first reviewing the evolution of intelligence itself.
The entirety of the human brain's 4 billion year story can be summarized as the culmination of 5 evolutionary breakthroughs, starting from the very first brains all the way to the modern human brains. Each breakthrough emerged from a new set of brain modifications and equipped animals with a new suite of intellectual faculties. These 5 breakthroughs are the organizing map to this book, and they make up our itinerary for our adventure back in time. Indeed, there were plenty of surprises along the way. For instance, the innovation that enabled AI to beat humans in the game of Go, temporal difference reinforcement learning, was an innovation discovered by our fish ancestors over 500 million years ago. The solutions to many of the current mysteries in AI, such as common sense, can be found in the tiny brain of a mouse. Where do emotions come from? Research suggests that they may have arisen simply as a solution to navigation in ancient worm brains. Unravelling this evolutionary story will reveal the hidden features of human intelligence, and with them, just how your mind came to be.
Around 4 billion years ago, deep in the volcanic oceans of a lifeless Earth. Just the right soup of molecules were bouncing around the microscopic nooks and crannies of an unremarkable hydrothermal vent. As boiling water burst from the seafloor, it smashed naturally occurring nucleotides together and transformed them into long molecular chains that closely resembled today's DNA. These early DNA-like molecules were short-lived. The same volcanic kinetic energy that constructed them also inevitably ripped them apart, such is the consequence of the second law of thermodynamics. That unbreakable law of physics, which declares that entropy, the amount of disorder in a system, always and unavoidably increases. The universe cannot help but tend toward decay. After countless random nucleotide chains were constructed and destroyed, a lucky sequence was stumbled upon, one that marked, at least on Earth, the first true rebellion against the seemingly inexorable onslaught of entropy. This new DNA-like molecule wasn't alive per se, but it performed the most fundamental process by which life would later emerge. It duplicated itself. Although these self-replicating DNA-like molecules also succumbed to the destructive effects of entropy, they didn't have to survive individually to survive collectively. As long as they endured long enough to create their own copies, they would, in essence, persist. This is the genius of self-replication. With these first self-replicating molecules, a primitive version of the process of evolution began. Any new lucky circumstances that facilitated more successful duplication would, of course, lead to more duplicates.
A Brief History of Intelligence by Max Bennett is read by George Newbern and runs for 12 hours, 18 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 7 a.m. with a different tale at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.